For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and over the next 2 weeks, we'll be looking back at the highlights of some of the audio that we've recorded over 2021. Coming up in the next hour, we'll meet an extraordinary veteran of the First World War who flew a biplane to Darjeeling, then set out to become the first man to conquer Everest. Kate Wilkinson takes us onto the London Underground and into the magical world of Edie and the Box of Flits. Top children's author Jason Reynolds shares his reaction to winning the 2021 Silip Carnegie Medal. And RNIB volunteer and blind chef Kim Jay shares her love of reading through the books of her life. But first, 2021 started off as usual with the annual Costa Book Awards. Only one of the six category winners could be crowned Costa Book of the Year, and the honour went to The Mermaid of Black Conch by Trinidadian-born British author Monique Roffey. Set in 1976 on a tiny Caribbean island, it's a bittersweet love story that one reviewer described as a fishy tale of doomed womanhood.
A merwoman. He stared at the spot of her appearance for some time. He took a good look at his spliff. Was it something real strong he smoked that morning? He shook himself and gazed hard at the sea, waiting for her to pop back up. Come back! He shouted into the deep greyness. The mermaid had held her head up high above the waves, and he'd seen a certain expression on her face, like she'd been studying him. He waited.
Ben Onwuke, narrating The Mermaid of Black Conch, written by Monique Roffey, who joins me now.
The Mermaid of Black Conch is a 21st century rewrite of a very ancient Taino myth where a group of women curse a younger woman into exile, into being a mermaid, and to be forever banished and cast out into the sea. And my novel starts with her being recaptured in the 1970s. I've set it in a modern times, and it then is a kind of what if we caught this mermaid and how would we take care of her kind of story.
Your mermaid is banished for being too beautiful and having too beautiful a voice by the other indigenous women of the Caribbean island that she came from thousands of years ago. And it's an example of people turning on themselves.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, when we look at our legends and myths from thousands of years ago, we see this again and again, don't we? Whether it's Caribbean mythology or European mythology, we see that we, as human beings, haven't evolved and we've always been prone to jealousy and malicious behaviour. And so, yeah, I wanted to sort of give this old myth an update and give my mermaid a chance for romantic love.
And she meets and is eventually rescued by a very charming Rastafarian fisherman called David, who can't quite believe his eyes when he catches her.
Well, initially she's caught by some American fishermen who've hired a local crew, and they take her back to the jetty and they string her up, and they have monetarized her immediately and want to sell her. And David sees the mermaid when they've all basically drifted into the bar to have a drink, and he cuts her down and rescues her, and his intention is to put her back in the sea. But before he can, she starts to sort of wither away and she loses her fishiness quite quickly. And the novel is partially narrated by him in an epistolary form. So we get a kind of Cupid writing about Psyche, which flips that myth as well a bit. We get the man looking back on this event, talking about the impact of this love story that it had on his life.
You mention the narrative voices, and David writes his recollections in a wonderful laconic Creole English that is brought beautifully to life by Ben Onwuke in the audiobook version. And your mermaid's voice is brought to life equally wonderfully. She speaks in a kind of free verse, which comes from everywhere and nowhere.
I had all kinds of thoughts about her because language and the acquisition of language is quite a big part of the book as well. So how would she speak if she hadn't spoken for thousands of years? And so, well, initially I really wanted to invent some kind of mermaid language that I would write the whole book in. But I thought that might be a bit too much of a stretch. And so I just had to think about the mermaid a lot, how she would speak. And in the end, I compromised in that she doesn't have the whole book. Her voice does appear in the book, and it's an amalgam of Caribbean Creole parlance, her own language, English, and I thought, let it come out as it comes onto the page in a kind of free verse. It was a long process of thinking and devising and writing and crossing it out and then thinking, how am I going to do this?
And the first language that she learns when she comes back to land is sign language, taught to her by a 10-year-old boy who is deaf. Mm.
Yeah. So we were pre-verbal at one point, a long time ago, when we were hunter-gatherers. We didn't have language early on. We probably grunted at each other and pointed a lot. I kind of thought, okay, this is going to be something she could pick up quite easily, which is sign language, hand language. Mm. So, yeah, she absorbs several types of language, all of which are around her. So she gets sign language quite quickly. And then she's taught standard English, but she's taught it by somebody who doesn't speak standard English. She speaks Creole English. So she's kind of learns three languages. And then, of course, her own language starts to come later on in the book.
And she is accepted by some of the people in this tiny village of Constance and threatened by others. It's her original home island from many, many years ago. But just as she was banished by jealous villagers, there are villagers who want to possess her or exploit her. And then there are villagers who will accept her for who she is. And it's a book that really pivots on the balance between otherness and acceptance.
Yes, I think that's what I'm writing towards. She gets to live again, but she's facing the same problems, which is jealousy. And I think the book also asks us who is bad and who isn't. I mean, the Americans are so sort of obviously colonial in their interest in her and wanting to monetize her and traffic her. But the people themselves are also blinded by the possibilities of her rarity and sort of asks, okay, who isn't going to sell her? Who is above this? Who isn't going to make a buck? There is a big question there about the old thing about torture. We all think torture is a bad people, but wonder how many of us could easily succumb once we were handed the power. So there is this question there about who would cash in. And also, she's very rare and exquisitely other. And yeah, she's a great metaphor for anybody who's marginalized and doesn't fit in.
I did wonder when we have the scene of her being strung up with the other fish caught by the Americans. I had a very strong image from my sighted days of a picture of a rather smug-looking Ernest Hemingway standing by the marlin he'd just caught. And I wondered if maybe that had been an inspiration for you as well.
Very much so. So I am in some ways writing back to Ernest Hemingway as well, who seemed to glorify blood sports, whether it was bullfighting or catching big fish. I've also seen those photographs of Hemingway and the marlin. And there's one in particular that I find really gruesome where he's standing in front of like five or six that have been strung up. And these creatures are enormous. They're much bigger than a man. And of course, we don't see fish like that in the sea anymore because they've all been fished. If you read The Islands in the Stream by Hemingway, there is a catch scene early on with similar type of fishermen and a father and a son. And it takes chapters and chapters to catch this fish. So I did look at that. So Hemingway was my go-to person initially.
And whilst there is obviously the reflection on ecological destruction and otherness and jealousy, there is also some wonderfully malevolent humour provided by your nosy neighbour Priscilla and the venal police chief in the book.
I really like that character, Priscilla, because I hope she comes across as complicated as well. I mean, don't you think that every village has got the scold, the harridan, the gossip? You know, the person who will always poke their nose into other people's business. So that's true, I don't think, just of the Caribbean, but anywhere in the world, there's someone you don't want looking over your fence. And so she's a bit of an archetype as well. She's like, you're going to marry a fish? What? So she gets some really good lines.
One of the other things that really came through in the book is how in small communities, disabilities are very often just taken as a matter of fact rather than a matter of particular note. Reggie is deaf and people accept it because that is part of him. And that's actually quite refreshing.
With Reggie, it's set in the 70s and I wanted him to have a sense of solidarity. I wanted him to be quite a political deaf young man who'd met a young Californian private tutor who'd shown him a different way of being with himself. Like, I think it says he doesn't necessarily want to wear a hearing aid. He doesn't want to fit in. He's a poet. He's waiting to go off to a deaf college in America. And at some point, Priscilla says, you know, he's not stupid. He's just deaf. I think definitely my knowledge of the Caribbean is that these things, even race, you know, people are very matter of fact about naming disability and or race or anything that here might be seen as a faux pas or something that we need to be very, very sensitive about.
Monique Rothy, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of The Mermaid of Black Conch, and many congratulations again.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
The Mermaid of Black Conch by Monique Rothy is available from the RNIB Library, and it's certainly one of my favourite books of the year.
RNIB is helping people with sight loss keep up to date during the coronavirus pandemic by offering a free subscription to a newspaper or broadcast guide via its news agent service. RNIB Newsagent provides plain text email versions of major UK newspapers and TV and radio guides, which can be easily read with magnification or screen reading software. This offer means that anyone who finds it difficult to read a paper or TV guide in their current print or online formats can get easy access to their favourite publication for free for up to 3 months. We would like to acknowledge the support of NLA Media Access for helping us to provide this. For a full list of what publications are available from RNIB Newsagent, or to sign up to the service, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email helpline@rnib.org.uk. RNIB, standing with you through every challenge.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show, reviewing the last 12 months in books. Coming up soon, Carnegie Medal winner Jason Reynolds reveals his close personal ties to sight loss, and Kate Wilkinson takes us onto the London Underground and into the magical world of Edie and the Box of Flits. But before that, many years ago, I remember hearing the bizarre story of a First World War veteran who, in 1933, attempted to fly a Gypsy Moth biplane from London to the lower slopes of Mount Everest, and then climb the as-yet-unconquered mountain alone. His story, however, was just a footnote in Everest's history, and no one had really bothered to research it further. But now, award-winning author Ed Caesar has done just that in his book The Moth and the Mountain, which offers a compelling portrait of a man damaged by war and propelled by an inner belief. Before Ed Caesar joins me, here's a clip.
Wilson had been expressly forbidden by the British authorities, both in India and at home in England, to make the journey. The Tibetan government had not given him permission to enter their kingdom, and the British were anxious to avoid a diplomatic incident. If Wilson was discovered at any point on his trek, he would be arrested. He knew he was in most danger of apprehension on the first part of his journey, out of Darjeeling and through the British protectorate of Sikkim, with its leech-infested rivers, verdant forests, and sparkling waterfalls. For that reason, he had paid his hotel bill 6 months in advance to throw the police off the scent. He also planned to leave Darjeeling at midnight in disguise as a Tibetan priest.
Chris Dyer narrating The Moth and the Mountain, written by Ed Caesar, who joins me now.
Maurice Wilson was born in 1898, and he was the son of a Bradford mill owner. He fought in the First World War with incredible bravery. He won the Military Cross there. And like many other veterans of that conflict, never quite recovered from what had happened to him on the Western Front. His period after the war was spent in a kind of restless mania, traveling all around the world, New Zealand, Mozambique, Canada. And he became very unhappy and very depressed. And a big idea that he thought could save him was to become the first person to reach the summit of Everest. And he left England in 1933 in a Gypsy Moth biplane, which he intended to fly all the way to the Himalayas. And then to get out of the plane, having landed it near Everest, and then to scale to its summit on his own. It was an absolutely bananas plan, but it was born out of this restlessness, a sense of not being able to find purpose. So it's really a story about escape. And his life is a very strange life in many ways, but his story is really born out of trauma, not finding a place in the world, and then doing this wildly expressive and interesting thing to try and overcome those problems in his life.
And he taught himself how to fly, obviously with the help of a flying instructor, but he wasn't a natural flyer. He certainly was no mountaineer. He'd been to Snowdon a couple of times, but he was rather frowned upon by the alpinists who were attempting Everest at the time. And yet he had phenomenal self-belief and a good streak of Yorkshire bloody-mindedness.
I think that's absolutely right. There is no doubt he is an eccentric. He is also such a formidable human being. Anyone who can walk from Darjeeling to the foot of Everest, carrying much of their own gear, having never crossed that terrain before in their lives, is a hardy specimen. You know, he did it in a little over 2 weeks, which is an extraordinary lick that he got there. He overcame so many problems. He overcame the complete opposition of the civil service, both in England and India, to his mission. They tried to turn him back at every stage. He hoodwinked them. He got fuel when he shouldn't have done. He outwitted emissaries of the British Empire wherever he found them. He was in so many ways just a very admirable person. In other ways, perhaps, you know, his treatment of women, his personal life, less admirable. But certainly he broke the mold, and there aren't many people in history like him.
And yet, for the most part, Maurice Wilson has just been ignored as a crank.
Yes, and that was a big motivation for me in writing the book. I felt that he'd been written off from almost the moment that he set foot on Everest. The Everest parties of the time in 1933 and 1935 found him very strange and his motivation very strange. Even if, at least in the 1935 party, they admired his courage. After that point, when Everest was eventually scaled successfully in 1953, his story was resuscitated again by a British journalist named Dennis Roberts. And there was a short book written about Maurice Wilson called I'll Climb Mount Everest Alone in 1957. And that book is quite condescending towards Wilson. And I feel like that set the narrative around him forevermore. I was motivated, in a sense, by reading that book and thinking, well, there just must be more to the Wilson story than this. He wasn't just a hapless eccentric with strange ideas about the world. People don't decide to fly their planes to Everest and then try to climb it on their own on a whim. There has to be something deep pushing you there. So I wanted to, if not reinstate him to his rightful place, at least to show the world what had driven him to do something so extraordinary. And I hope that I've achieved that.
And as you point out in the book, you're not alone in holding him in quite some esteem as far as his endeavours are concerned. One of the greatest mountaineers of all time, Reinhold Messner, who was actually the first man to solo Everest, which is what Wilson was trying to do, holds him in equal esteem.
Yeah, that was a remarkable discovery for me. Messner's an interesting and difficult character himself, hard-bitten, very dismissive sometimes of other climbers, a vast personality. And he wrote this beautiful book called The Crystal Horizon, which describes his solo of Everest in 1980, in which Wilson plays an outsized role. Very high up on the mountain at 26,000 feet, Messner is lost in a waking vision about Wilson, thinking, God, if Wilson had got up here, I think he would have made it to the summit. And Wilson serves as a kind of spiritual talisman for Messner. Messner admires Wilson's doggedness. He says he's tougher than I am. All the qualities that Wilson possessed, all of his best qualities, Messner wishes he had more of, which is quite something for someone who was the first to summit all of the world's 8,000 meter peaks. And it was interesting. I went out to the Dolomites to meet Messner in his castle in Bolzano Bozen. And Messner was there with his huge craggy face and ice blue eyes and somewhat forbidding demeanor. And he really warmed up when I talked about Wilson. And it was clear to me that Wilson had not released his grip on Messner, even after all these years.
That resilience Messner clearly identified in Wilson really comes through in his diary, his notebooks. I mean, he was clearly a man who was fighting some pretty awful demons as a result of the First World War. Not only his own injuries, but actually his brother came back with terrible shell shock and never recovered. Yet, I suppose that's what drives Wilson on, that need to prove himself, to feel alive rather than lead a half-life.
I think that's right. You really get this sense with Wilson that it's not just about what's happened to him. It's about coming back to a city in Bradford that had been ruined by the First World War, because so many young men had joined the Pals battalions and so many had not come back. It's a city of widows and darkness and of a wool trade that's fast declining after the First World War. So many school friends and friends who played sport with the Wilsons, and they're all gone forever. So you're coming back into this changed environment. And in the same house as Maurice Wilson is his brother Victor, who shakes and who has nightmares, and who can't work ever again, having been deeply affected by his service in the two battles of Bull Court in 1917. That's what Wilson comes back to. And I think it's too simplistic to say that Wilson was traumatized. I think the whole city was traumatized. Wilson found it unbearable in the immediate aftermath of the war and got out of Bradford and got out of England and started this period of travel that never really finished. It finishes at Everest. This mania to move eventually finds its way to the Himalayas.
And of course, there are parallels with George Mallory, who was also a First World War veteran, who also felt that need to go into the beckoning silence and find peace in his own head.
It's interesting when you look at how many people in the expeditions of the 1920s had served in the First World War. It's a huge proportion of them. You have veterans of the Somme, you have veterans of Passchendaele, you have people who've suffered in all sorts of ways. And oddly, those missions were somewhat divided between older Brits for whom the adventure felt almost like a Victorian adventure, and younger climbers like Mallory, for whom it was a more modern, more reflective journey, a sort of journey of the soul. Reading Mallory's letters home and his diaries, you do get a sense of someone reckoning with deep currents in their self, I suppose. And for them, as Wade Davis writes in his incredible book, Into the Silence, Everest had become like a sentinel in the sky. You know, you come out of the mud of Flanders and the thing that you're looking towards is this absolutely majestic, forbidding seemingly unattainable peak shining high in the sky, as much metaphor as it was real mountain.
The Moth and the Mountain by Ed Caesar is out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books.
The RNIB is committed to providing life-changing support and specialist services. Services that we know people affected by sight loss need now more than ever. But we need your help. The coronavirus outbreak represents an unprecedented situation for all of us. For RNIB, it's having a huge impact on our ability to raise the money we need to continue vital services at a time when so many of us are feeling isolated and anxious. The need for access to information and to feel socially connected is critical for all of us. With an increase in demand, we're working hard to keep vital services running so that blind and partially sighted people don't have to face this crisis alone. But we need your help. This is a time for community and coming together, and we need your support now more than ever. Please help RNIB today to support the 2 million people in the UK with sight loss, their friends, family and carers. Donate at 0330 002 0893, or use the website rnib.org.uk/urgent appeal. Thank you.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. And now... I still remember my first trip to London as a small boy. We travelled up from Sussex to visit London Zoo, but I was far more fascinated by the underground trains, and even though I must by now have spent thousands of hours in its clattering carriages, that frisson of excitement about the tube has never left me. It's a feeling I share with Kate Wilkinson, whose debut novel for children, Edie and the Box of Flits, is built around the tube network, as she told me when she joined me from her home in London.
It's a chapter book for 8 to 11-year-olds, and it's about a girl called Edie Winter, who's 11, and her dad runs the London Transport Lost Property Office, which is loosely based on the Transport for London one that was in Baker Street, as I was very lucky enough to go and visit during my research. Anyway, this character, Edie Winter, she's just started secondary school and she's going through, I think, what often happens when children leave a relatively small and friendly primary school and move to a big secondary, sometimes with 9 classes of 30 or whatever, as that's what happened to my son anyway. And in the case of Edie, she's not really ready for that and she still wants to play those kind of playground games. And what she's discovered is that her old primary school friends have slightly dumped her and gone off to be with the popular gang and look at their phones and think about clothes and stuff like that. So the book starts with Edie pretty lonely, really. She spends the first half term with her dad, decides that she's going to help him with work on the Lost Property Office. And they go out and about looking for abandoned and missing items on the London Underground. And on the Piccadilly line, she spots an abandoned box on a seat across the carriage in front of her. And they collect the box and take it back to the Lost Property Office. And as Edie is handing it over to Dad to register it and everything, she feels something fluttering inside. And so begins this adventure, which stretches out over the London Underground to abandoned, wild, derelict wilderness stations, and then ends up with a big denouement, big scene in a ghost station deep underground, because I've always been so interested by those strange secret corners of the London Underground. And the flits of the title, they turn out to be thumb-sized creatures, small people really, definitely not fairies, Red, I should say that, definitely not fairies. But they are in trouble, and Edie sets out to help them. And that's really the premise of the book.
And the flits can only be seen by children, not by adults. And as you say, they are in trouble. They need to get home, and one of them is missing.
That's right. One of them is missing. Something strange is going on. Someone is stealing the flits and using them for their own devices, and it turns out that they are in fact being used by the villain of the piece, who's Vera Creech, and she's an employee at the Lost Property Office. And she is stealing these flits because they have such tiny fingers. They're perfect for a huge spate of pickpocketing on the London Underground, stealing valuables of all kinds, which, of course, has a big impact on the Lost Property Office because people come to them and they're not finding things which are going missing. So it ends up that Edie and her friends have to find out what's happened to the missing flits and also where all these valuables are going on the London Underground, why so many passengers are complaining that stuff's going missing and isn't being found. I love the theme of lost and found because I think also at that age, which Edie is, and that's why I wanted this idea of childhood and the fact that when you get to 13, you can't see them anymore, because I think the book's about that moment when our childhood ends, really, and we don't spend so much time daydreaming, lost in our imagination, and the peer group sort of kicks in and you start to join the adult world and reality. So that's really why I use the idea of the Lost Property Office and being lost and found, because that's the sort of theme of the whole book, I suppose.
And where better to set it than on the Underground, which is labyrinthine and confusing and the start and terminus of so many people's journeys. I believe that this story was actually inspired by seeing a mouse at Highbury and Islington Tube Station.
Yeah, absolutely, because I actually live out at Palmer's Green now, so the best way to get to us is to get the Overground, which is the Moorgate line, but it starts underground. So at Highbury and Islington, you come off the Victoria line and you connect with the Overground, but it's an underground station. But because it's an overground train, you often have to wait 15 minutes, sometimes 30 minutes if you're not lucky. So I've spent hours of my time sitting on a bench on that dusty old platform. And I started to notice this family of fabulously gritty, grubby mice who sort of whir around, you know, like those kind of wind up mice, you know, dragging bits of broken crisp and crusts of old sandwiches to a hidey hole. And then as soon as the big train blew in, you know, that kind of wind that comes in through the tunnels, they'd scuttle off, disappear completely into the walls. And I think it made me think about what it would be like to have a parallel world down there, that other creatures who live from foraging and stuff that goes on in those tunnels. So yes, I love it too. I'm glad you like it, because I love some of the architecture. I love the hidden London side of things, you know, the secret places.
And as you say, those ghost tube stations that we rattle through almost without noticing, and you just wonder what is going on in those places that haven't been touched since the 1940s.
That's right, exactly. And all the strange sounds down there. And I went to a school actually in Oxfordshire because I thought I need to make sure that this book isn't so London-centred, that it's not going to appeal to anyone outside London. But I think it really did, because I think that sort of network of tunnels and the London Underground being built when it was, the tunnels are so tiny, because if you go to other cities, there's much more space around you, but it's that fact that you're in a sort of burrow down there that makes it quite particular.
Now, the flits themselves have a very specific diet that they ask Edie to help them satisfy. And they rather reminded me of the borrowers, little people who have to rely on their bigger human neighbours for provisions.
Absolutely. I mean, I love the borrowers. And of course, there's a huge influence there, very much so. But it was sort of updating it to the modern world. So there's a big scene when Nid, who's one of the flits and very sort of acrobatic, is determined to upend a huge box of Rice Krispies so that he can fulfill his desire and eat all these Rice Krispies. So he does a very complex series of manoeuvres involving the sugar spoon and jumping off a bowl and pushing the entire box of cereal onto the floor so that he can scoop it all up. But yes, they do. And they love things like those sugar sprinkles, you know, the coloured sprinkles, and Marmite. It's a very modern day diet, but one that would appeal to little people, definitely.
And the audiobook version has been brought wonderfully to life by Charlie Sanderson, who I think was just born to read this kind of book. And I know it was very important to you that it should be an audiobook, as well as the beautifully illustrated paperback copy that is also available.
That's right. Yeah, audiobooks are a bit in my DNA because I spent about 15 years working for the BBC as a radio producer and then went freelance. And now, because of the amazing boom in audiobooks, I spend a lot of time producing audiobooks. Not so many for children, sadly. I wish I could. So I do have a particular interest in them. And I think Charlie Sanderson's such a good reader, mainly because she doesn't fall into that trap. I think it's quite easy with people coming to children's books to immediately sort of put on a very high pitched voice and and it's all a bit sort of ditzy and it just doesn't quite work. Whereas I think what's great about her, she has a very lovely voice and she's absolutely got that thing of keeping a very steady narration and then just breaking into the voices when you need them and doesn't over dramatize it too much, which is always a danger, I think, with audiobooks. But she also makes the children wise and sensible and, yes, a bit crazy if it needs to be, but never making them silly or ditzy. And that's what's so good about her, I think.
The screeches and squawks of a dozen birds bounced off the walls of the tunnel. Just out of reach of their sharp, nipping beaks, the family hurtled along in a ragged line, trying to escape. "Faster," said the oldest boy at the front, his head no bigger than a matchstick, and his wings whirring like a tiny windmill in a storm. Up ahead, the tunnel divided into two. "Take the left turn," shouted his sister from just behind him. They shot to the left and disappeared round a bend. Within seconds, the screeches began to fade. It was clear that their pursuers had gone the other way.
"Let's stop," gasped the youngest. "Just for a minute."
They landed on an electricity junction box just beside the train tracks. The youngest did a quick head count.
"Where's Flum?"
he said, his voice suddenly panicky. Only minutes before she had been there, flying behind them.
"Flum!"
he called back into the tunnel. There was silence. Flum had disappeared.
Charlie Sanderson narrating Edie and the Box of Flits, written by my guest, Kate Wilkinson.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
Welcome back to this Read On retrospective of 2021. The Philip Carnegie Medal is the world's oldest and most prestigious award for children's literature. Past winners include many of the best-known and most-loved children's authors of the last nine decades. And, as regular listeners to Read On will know, competition this year was particularly stiff. However, there could only be one winner, and the winner of the 2021 Philip Carnegie Medal is Jason Reynolds for Look Both Ways. Jason, many congratulations.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So, for the one or two people who might not yet have picked up Look Both Ways, could you give us a very quick overview?
Sure. Look Both Ways is a collection of stories that makes one whole story about a bunch of kids who go to the same school and the independent and individual journeys that they all take on their different walks home.
They might all attend the same school, but they've got very different backgrounds and home lives. And part of the title, Look Both Ways, is not just telling them to watch out for themselves, but also to see things from different points of view.
Right. You know, it's interesting, right? Because I think young people sit next to each other every day. I think teachers sort of look in their classrooms and they see all these kids who are side by side and sharing lunch tables and sharing food and sharing lockers. But the truth is that every kid has a very separate journey. And that in order for us to really appreciate the beauty of our children, we have to understand that each of them actually, as much as they are the same, they are different. And if we could teach them this, that like to look both ways, to say that there are many different perspectives, there are many different lives, there are many different lives within each and every one of you, then I think we get a better grasp, a truer grasp on the world.
We certainly get that in those 15 unsupervised minutes where children are just themselves. They're not conforming to any teacher or parent's view of what they should be.
Exactly, right? Like when we think of, especially when it comes to children's stories, we think of school or we think of home. But the truth is, there is a liminal space, right? There's actually this strange sort of buffering space of freedom where there are no adults, where you're just on a journey, you're on an adventure. And that's where you really discover who you are. That's where you discover the world you actually live in. That's where you discover who your friends are, what your fears are, what your dreams are, right? Like that particular 15-minute window where the sort of down-pressing hand of adults or the watchful eye of neighbors really aren't there to sort of guide you or get in the way of your childlike expression.
The judges cited their reason for choosing the book because it is an innocent tale that covers hard-hitting issues, including bullying, homophobia, and bereavement, which are not always things that are covered in children's books, but are actually part of everyday life for an awful lot of kids.
Absolutely. And my job isn't to teach them or give them any answers. My job is simply to present them with questions. You know, imagine a world where we teach young people to wrestle with the world around them. We teach them to wrestle with right and wrong, right? Instead of this binary, interesting, bifurcated way that's oftentimes reductive when it comes to our everyday lives. What if we actually presented information and we framed it in a way that was meant for them, and then we allowed them the space to wrestle with it so that I don't have to say, here is the right answer. Instead, I say, here is the situation. Now you wrestle. Right. You tap into your empathy here. I've set up guideposts, but I don't want to give it all away because that's not actually my job. My job is to bear witness to your lives and to respect you enough to allow you to do a little bit of that work on your own.
And I know that you're the U.S. ambassador for children's literacy. And we've discussed before, you were a late reader yourself. But actually, you really do provide a role model for any children who might be hesitant about their own literacy, about expressing their own thoughts, because it hasn't come easy to you and it didn't come the normal way of maybe studying books at school. For you, it came through music.
For me, it came through music, absolutely. I mean, I was a young person who, it's not that I didn't want to read or that I couldn't read, it's that I didn't think reading was for me. I didn't think I had a place in it because I'd never seen my face in it. It's that simple, right? And so because of that, I gravitated towards music. Rap music was big in my time. And as I was coming up, that was the phenomenon. It still is, obviously, a global phenomenon. But when I was growing up, it was a new phenomenon. And I loved it. I didn't want to be a rapper, though. I wanted to just read the lyrics. That's what introduced me to poetry. And from there, I realized that language had power.
It's second time lucky for you with the Philip Carnegie Medal. You were shortlisted for Long Way Down in 2019. What does winning this particular literary award mean to you?
It means a lot of things. You know, I think ultimately the Carnegie is a big deal for me because it lets me know that, like, perhaps, just maybe, I've written some universal stories, right? And it lets me know that young people gravitate toward this. But I have to be honest with you. There is a chip on my shoulder. And this award also means something else for me. Sometimes, as an American writer who's so grateful to be published over there. But, you know, there were some hard times in the beginning of that process because people would always say that my stories were too American, right? Like that was a thing. But I've traveled the world with these stories, and I know that young people from every culture, every background, from all over the world, laugh at the same jokes, that there are these intersections and these connections that they all understand. That there's a youth culture that actually transcends any actual nationality. And I've been arguing this for a very long time. And so what does the Carnegie mean for me? More than anything, it means that actually my stories aren't American stories. They're human stories. They're about young people. they're not too American. And this proves that they're not too American because y'all chose it as the winner.
And certainly that universality is caught in the subject matter, because any child who is fortunate enough to be able to go to school has that 15-minute walk home. One thing that is unique to the Carnegie Medal winner is that you get a copy of your book in Braille. Have you got plans for that?
You know what? I'm going to put it in my archive. The reason why that's important to me, though, is because I actually am the grandson of a blind man, and he is no longer alive. I wish he were here so that he could read Look Both Ways now that it's going to be in Braille, you know. But I grew up with a blind man, and so I'm very familiar with sight loss and with blindness and with Braille and with sort of just being in community with people who cannot see. And so this is actually really emotional for me to know that that is a part of this victory, is that book in Braille. It means the world to me. And it's also bittersweet because my grandfather was my father's father. And so what I would do is give this book to my father, but unfortunately he's no longer alive either. And so I'll keep it for myself and tuck it away.
Well, Jason Reynolds, Philip Carnegie Medal winning author of Look Both Ways, many congratulations on your success, and I look forward to inviting you back onto the show in years to come with stories to come.
I appreciate it, and good to talk to you.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Start your day with a morning adventure every weekday from 8 a.m.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
A book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
And our usual talking book slot every weekday at 2 p.m. Or if you prefer a book at bedtime, it's repeated at 10 p.m. And you'll find many episodes online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
And now, to round off this, the first of two Read On specials looking back at 2021 in books, let's meet a blind chef with an appetite for audiobooks.
Many listeners will already know about Kim Jay. An avid cook and former restaurateur, she's based in the northwest of England, where she's one of RNIB's busiest volunteers. No stranger to adversity, she hasn't let sight loss or COVID stand in her way, and she's recently published two cookbooks, the proceeds of which go to RNIB. She's also an avid reader, so I was keen to find out the books of her life. Kim, was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
When I was a child, we came from Kenya when I was three. And by the age of three, I was always already reading. My mother said, you know, I was born with a book in front of my face. And we didn't have much money. And at the time, there was this great offer on a particular chocolate where if you collected the wrappers, sent them off, you got a Ladybird book. And my mother, that's what she did, because she knew I loved reading, didn't have much money, so she started collecting these chocolate wrappers. So it wasn't a particular book that set me on the path for reading and writing. It was a series of books. It was the amazing Ladybird fairy stories. One in particular really caught my attention, which was Cinderella. I loved Cinderella. I loved the pictures. I can still remember the gowns that she wore, pink, blue, white, yellow. And for me, it wasn't just about reading the book. When I got to the last page, even at the age of three or four, my memory and my imagination went riot. I carried on the story. So in my head, the ugly sisters were thrown out of the kingdom, went into a forest, and had all these adventures. And that was a great thing about the books as a child, that you could let your imagination go riot and do things and go places where you have never been before.
Cinderella is one of many classic stories contained in Ladybird Tales, the complete audio collection narrated by Wayne Forrester. which is available via Audible.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl called Cinderella. Her mother was dead, and she lived with her father and two stepsisters. Cinderella's stepsisters were fair of face, but because they were bad-tempered and unkind, their faces grew to look ugly. They were jealous of Cinderella because she was a lovely child, and so they were often unkind to her. The stepsisters made Cinderella do all the work in the house. She worked from morning till night without stopping. Cinderella not only did all the housework, but she also helped her stepsisters to dress. She cleaned their shoes, brushed their hair, tied their ribbons, and fastened their buckles.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Oh, definitely. It's a lovely series of books. The first one is called Daughter of the Forest by Juliet Mariella. That's Mariller. And this series is amazing. For me, it's like a comfort blanket. The first book in the trilogy is a fairy story. We all know the story of the 12 brothers that were turned into swans by the wicked stepmother. So it's based on that. So we have six brothers, and the wicked stepmother turns them into a swan, and the sister, Soka, has to knit them all shirts made from stalwart, which is a thistle plant in Ireland. Now, the book is set in Ireland, and the narrator is Irish, and she has this amazing Gaelic voice that just draws you in. And this story starts with Soka trying to make these shirts and go on this adventure, and it is absolutely heartwarming. You sit there and you start reading this book and you think, I'm an adult, I'm reading a fairy story, but it's a fairy story for adults. And it just makes you feel good, and it takes you back to when you were a child. By the end of the book, you put it down, and the first thing that I did, I ordered the next book in the series, and then the book after that, and the series after that. Each one of these books is amazing.
Three children lay on the rocks at the water's edge. A dark-haired little girl, two boys slightly older. This image is caught forever in my memory, like some fragile creature preserved in amber. Myself, my brothers. I remember the way the water rippled as I trailed my fingers across the shining surface.
Don't lean over so far, Soka, said Podrick. You might fall in.
He was a year older than me and made the most of what little authority that gave him. You could understand it, I suppose. After all, there were six brothers altogether, and five of them were older than he was. I ignored him, reaching down into the mysterious depths.
She might fall in, mightn't she, Finbar?
A long silence. As it stretched out, we both looked at Finbar, who lay on his back, full length on the warm rock.
Lara Hutchinson, narrating Daughter of the Forest by Juliet Mariella, which, like all the books in her Seven Waters series, is available from the RNIB library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
There is, and it's a classic book. I love my classic books. And it's A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irvine. It is a little bit of a difficult book to get into, but it is well worth reading. For me, John Irvine is a modern American version of Thomas Hardy. So a lot of his books is about social history and the environment at the time that he's writing in. So A Prayer for Owen Meany is set in the 1950s and 1960s, and it follows the story of two boys, John and Owen Meany. Now, Owen Meany is a small boy, eccentric, very remarkable, and extremely strange. You start reading it and you think, oh, there's no storyline to this. It's a book about two children growing up in New Hampshire in the 50s. But you're sort of drawn into their lives and you follow what they're doing and you get involved. And it is really interesting. And you get so drawn in that you miss something very, very important. And then I got to the chapter, the climax of the book. And I'm not going to tell you what happened. And I read this chapter and I stopped at the end of it. And all of a sudden, sparks started flying in my brain. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've missed everything. I now understand what he was going on about. And for the first time in my life, I went back to the beginning of the chapter and reread it again. And it was one of those light bulb moments where everything just sort of clicks into place and you think, now I understand. Finished the book, and then again, for the first time in my life and the only time, I went straight back to the beginning of the book and reread it. And this time, knowing how the story ends, I actually was reading the story behind the story, if that makes sense. And it just totally blew me away. It is hard going, but it is well worth having a read of this. It is a really good book.
I am doomed to remember a boy with a wrecked voice. Not because of his voice, or because he was the smallest person I ever knew, or even because he was the instrument of my mother's death, but because he is the reason I believe in God. I am a Christian because of Owen Meany. I make no claims to have a life in Christ or with Christ, and certainly not for Christ, which I've heard some zealots claim. I'm not very sophisticated in my knowledge of the Old Testament, and I've not read the New Testament since my Sunday school days, except for those passages that I hear read aloud to me when I go to church. I'm somewhat more familiar with the passages from the Bible that appear in the Book of Common Prayer. I read my prayer book often, and my Bible only on holy days. The prayer book is so much more orderly.
Garrick Hagen, narrating A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving, which is available from the RNIB Library. Kim J, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the listeners and for being a guest on the show.
No, thank you.
And don't forget, Kim J's two fabulous accessible cookbooks are both available from Amazon. Her surname is spelt J-A-Y-E, and the two book titles are A Taste of Spice and A Sense of Cooking, the proceeds of which go to RNIB.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week with the second of our two shows, looking back on the best of books from 2021. In the meantime, why not treat yourself and subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Red Sail and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests this year, and to you for listening. Wishing you all a very happy Yuletide full of warmth and cheer. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.